Well, thanks for inviting me to the program and enjoying my time here. So what I'm going to talk about is work that's at least in part done, been done with Louisa Buckman, who's a student of mine in Seattle. And so and we have a paper that's actually been published in PhysRev, which explains at least, you know, again, part of what I'm talking about today. And it's largely inspired by this Estabrook, Robinson, and Wahlquist paper of a few years ago. They, you know, developed a tetrad formalism, which differs in some respects from what I'm going to talk about, but in terms of the gauge conditions for the evolution of the tetrad, it's the same. And of course, there have been a number of other, this is just, you know, a list of papers that, you know, were particularly relevant to, you know, I relied on. It's not meant to be a complete list of references. And there have been a number of papers on tetrad formalisms, but, and we're not doing anything drastically innovative beyond them, but what we are trying to do is, you know, trying to reduce it to practice in a sense. There, Ben Putten did do some, you know, test calculations using the Ben Putten and early formalism, tetrad formalism. But on the whole, it's, you know, numerical relativism seems to me have largely ignored using, you know, have not used tetrads. And so there are some issues in how you actually make it work in a practical way, which I hope to discuss, and also some. So so why do we want to consider tetrads, given all the work that's been done with metrics? Well, one very important aspect is the tetrad metric is just the metric which you use to raise and lower indices is just, of course, the Minkowski metric. Now that really makes it simple to sort of combine things, particularly in nonlinear terms, instead of having, you know, inverse metrics floating around and which have some complicated structure. And you have just, you know, much, much simpler combinations, and you have many fewer terms than you do in a metric. And in fact, it's possible to sort of do everything by hand in terms of driving the equations without any huge amount of work. What?
Don't you have many more equations?
Well, somewhat more. Well, not really. I mean, I'll talk about that, but this actually turns out to be somewhat less because, you know, you do have additional gauge freedoms, of course, because you have the orientation of the tetrad to play with as well as the coordinates. So in that sense, you know, and that is a serious issue. So for instance, you know, because the connections are anisymmetric on a pair for the orthonormal basis as opposed to symmetric on a pair for the coordinate basis, there, you know, in 4D you have 24 rather than 40 Christoffel symbols in general. And in 3D, you have 9 versus 18. So that's a significant saving. Your variables, of course, when you're talking about connection coefficients, they aren't really physical, but they're much, you can interpret them sort of geometrically, and at least in terms of, you know, what the tetrad is doing and so on, you know, much more directly than you can say some component of a metric or what have you. Now, the tetrad gauge conditions, in other words, how the tetrad row lines accelerate, how the spatial legs of the tetrad rotate about, you know, the row lines, can be formulated, it's naturally formulated in a coordinate independent way, which is sort of nice. And furthermore, almost all of your variables, except for the actual, you know, components of the tetrad vector themselves, of the tetrad vectors, and there, that's one place, well, I'll come to it in the next slide, but most of the variables are coordinate scalars, and that means that when you do a derivative along the tetrad world line involving and have a shift of the coordinate system, spatial coordinates relative to that world line, then because you're just differentiating scalars, you don't have any derivatives of the shift coming in, which again is a simplification. So you don't have to deal with, you know, all the mess you have in say dealing with Lie derivatives of the extrinsic curvature or something in a metric based formalism. Okay, so these are some of the advantages, but of course there are some disadvantages too. And as Jim pointed out, you need more gauge conditions. You have to evolve both the tetrad frames and your coordinate system, and that's a complication. Now and that's particularly true if the frames, as in some of the systems I'm going to talk about, if they don't have any fixed orientation relative to the, in other words, the tetrad world lines are not orthogonal to the your space like hypersurfaces. They're just evolving in some way determined by the tetrad gauge condition, which in principle has nothing to do with the coordinate system. that causes complications, because then you have to deal with the fact that for instance, a derivative along, you know, a tetrad vector, what you think of as a spatial tetrad vector, because it's orthogonal to your time tetrad vector, isn't really tangent to the hypersurface, so that, you know, that directional derivative, that's quote spatial directional derivative, actually has a time derivative hidden in it, and you have to deal with that. But it is possible to deal with it, but it does add complication. And also because, and same reason, when you deal with commutation of directional derivatives, that's not as trivial as commutation of coordinate derivatives. Again, you just have to deal with it. And there are more tetrad vector components. In other words, in describing the metric, well, you basically have, and not counting the shift and the lapse, which have somewhat different meanings in the metric and tetrad formalisms, but are basically the same idea. There are, you have the, you know, basically the six components of the spatial metric in the metric formalism. Now, describe the spatial, sort of spatial geometry, you have, in the tetrad formalism, you have the tetrad vector, spatial components of the tetrad vectors, or it's not quite the correct way of saying it, but it's roughly right. And there are nine of those, so you know, that means you have more variables, well, you have fewer connection coefficients, you have more sort of metric-like variables in the tetrad formalism. And what I think may ultimately be most serious objection is that if you want to have gauge conditions which sort of have your coordinate system and your description of things evolve in a way which is asymptotically stationary, as say some collapse relaxes to a stationary black hole, then you want your coordinate systems, you know. There are ideas about how to do that in the metric formalism in terms of having dynamic lapse and shift, but it's not much less clear unless how you do that, because in the tetrad formalism, because you have to deal with, to have a stationary description in the tetrad formalism, you have to have both the tetrad frames and the how the coordinates are moving relative to those frames behave in a stationary way, in the sense that with the shift vector you can make everything simultaneously time independent. And that's it's not so obvious how to do that in the tetrad form, is it?
I mean, you can't just have the tetrad directions coincide with x, y, z, and t.
Well, your coordinate directions are generally not going to be orthogonal, so. Well, you can, one thing which I think, well, I'll talk about, I think is desirable, is to choose the time direction so that it's orthogonal to your space-like hypersurfaces, your constant coordinate time hypersurfaces. And that, but you still have to deal with the rotation of the, you know, of the spatial legs of the tetrad. And those are not along coordinate directions. And so you, so it's just something that hasn't been nearly as well explored as there may be ways to do it, but it's not.
Some of this is actually quite explored once upon a time, mm-hmm. because we do use the tetrad formula, yeah. We use the gauge you just said, and we do use gauge conditions on mm-hmm. the internal gauge of rotation.
So. Yeah. So yeah, I'm not familiar with that. So anyway, okay. So the first approaches which I want to talk about are, you might think of threading approaches or sort of 1+3 in the sense that you do not force the tetrad world lines to be orthogonal to the hypersurface. So you have tetrad world lines which are doing sort of their own thing, and then you have, and those define a time direction, and then you have spatial, well, the spatial legs of the tetrad doing something, and then you have your coordinate hypersurfaces doing something else, and your coordinate axes doing something else. So, you know, so this is, so this is one approach, and the first approach we consider, because that's the approach, sort of gauge conditions that the Estabrook, Robinson, Wahlquist people used, and also the early Putnam and Putnam. So the three basic ways of trying to evolve the tetrad vectors. One is to just say the acceleration and angular velocity of by angular velocity, it's the, you know, the angular velocity rotation relative Fermi-Walker transport of the spatial legs of the tetrad. Just fix those as functions of coordinates, right? It's like fixing a gauge, you know, having fixed lapse and shift, and not quite the same, but, you know, similar. The trouble is, you know, you don't know what to fix it to, and in general, and generally, if you try to fix it, you end up in some sort of disaster. So, now there are dynamic ways of doing it, and one of them was developed by Van Putten and Erdley, and they used what they call the Lorentz gauge, which basically means taking the connection one forms, or the Ricci rotation coefficients, thinking of them as one forms with, they have three indices, but two of the indices are defined by the, you know, the tetrad vectors are not considered, you know, tensor indices. You have a one sort of free index, and you take the divergence of that one form, set it equal to zero, and that's Lorentz gauge. I'll say a little more about that. And then the other is this Nestor gauge. Now that Nestor gauge has, you know, it's sort of interesting because the idea, basic idea is that, well, how do you, you know, how do you relate orientations of vectors across some finite distance in a curved space-time? You can't use parallel transport in a normal way because parallel transport is path-dependent. Now, so Nestor's idea is to define for the same geometry, the same metric, define a connection which has the property it has zero curvature but non-zero torsion, and it's possible to do that. And with zero curvature, that unphysical connection defines path-independent parallel transport. And so you can take, you know, a tetrad vectors at one point, at least say in the Euclidean space, and the idea is then you can move them to all other points in a you know, more or less unique way. Now, just how unique it really is, and their topological condition, you have to have topological conditions and so on for it to be unique. And it's not as firmly, you know, worked out, I think, in terms of rigorous theorems as, say, the initial value problem. And
what specifies the torsion? give the torsion estimates?
Well, in other words, you change the connection. When you change the curvature, you have to change the torsion. I mean, if you're using the same metric, right? I mean, it's not, you're not changing the actual, you know, proper distances in the space. You're just changing how you move vectors from one place to another in the space.
But then, isn't there some new structure in the new connection?
Well, so you can define, there are conditions on the connection that, so the basic idea is you can start from some arbitrary, just pick some arbitrary tetrad fields in space. And the idea is that you can then solve some elliptic equation in a three-dimensional space, solve some elliptic equations, which are, at least in some cases, have unique solutions modulo a global rotation, right? Which allow you then to rotate your initial sort of tetrad fields so that they have this special property that they are related by parallel transport under this funny different zero curvature connection.
Are there fewer functions specified in fixing the acceleration and angular velocity?
Well, so in the same idea in 4D, and there you don't really have uniqueness, but in terms of, you know, you have freedom in initial conditions and freedom in boundary conditions. But, and particularly initial conditions, but it turns out it does give you a unique evolution of the acceleration and angular velocity. But it doesn't give you a unique acceleration and angular velocity to start with, in terms of the 4D structure. Right.
Why are they called threading?
Well, because in this conventional 3+1, you're thinking of space-time as being made up of slices, right? But here you're thinking of space-time as being this congruence of world lines. And yeah, okay. So now, so the alternative to those descriptions is this: those ways of evolving the tetrad is to fix the tetrad to be orthogonal to some constant time hypersurfaces, where you evolve those by some dynamic equation for, you know, lapse, which is like some of the standard ones in conventional numerical relativity, in particular, say the Bonamassa dynamic lapse equation. Now, when you evolve the lapse, if the tetrad vectors are orthogonal to the hypersurfaces, then that means the acceleration of the tetrad world lines is always just the gradient of the lapse, basically. And so the acceleration then is determined by how your hypersurfaces are evolving. You still have the freedom of the spatial rotations, and one thing you can do is, well, one possible thing to do is just set that to zero. In other words, say just Fermi Walker transport from some initial tetrad. Now, I think there may be reasons why that's not the optimal thing to do, because if you have the tetrads being, may get twisted up in some way, and you like to have some sort of restoring force which tries to untwist them relative to, you know, some criterion. And okay, so what we, with, you know, help from Esterbrook and Wahlquist, found was then a way of, well, most of the systems in literature involve some sort of higher order systems. In other words, you know, for instance, the Van Putten early way of dealing with equations is to, they have second order wave equations for the connection coefficients. So there's sort of a third order system in a sense. And then you also have, various sorts of Bianchi systems where you evolve the Riemann tensor sort of independently of the connections. And again, that's sort of a third order system. So now, so what we've first set out to do is develop what we might call an Einstein Christoffel system in the context of tetrads, which just involves the connections and the, the tetrad vectors, and doesn't involve any higher order, higher derivatives. So it's, a first order, coupled first order system. Now, later on, I will also later on consider a particular Einstein-Bianchi system, in particular the one of Yvonne and Jimmy, published recently, but with some modifications to try to reduce the number of redundant variables. I mean, one problem with these higher order systems is you tend to have a lot more redundant variables, more constraints to satisfy, and more potential for unstable, or at least you worry that there might be a more potential for unstable constraint violating modes in these higher order systems. But there are some real advantages to going to this Einstein-Bianchi system, but we can do it in a way which minimizes the number of extra variables. Okay. So to actually get some sort of real numerical scheme out of this, you have to have a way of relating the tetrad variables and directional derivatives to coordinates and quadratic derivatives in a way suitable for numerical calculation. And of course, you want to look at the hyperbolic structure of the equations and make sure it's at least strongly hyperbolic and preferably symmetric hyperbolic. And so far we've just considered some very simple 1D test applications, Kleining plane waves, the spherical symmetry, spherical black holes, basically just Schwarzschild. So they're basically trivial applications, but still it's not that easy to get things to work. Well, at least for the Schwarzschild case. I mean, plane waves are fairly simple. Okay, at least to get, stable evolution. So in terms of notation, then I'm going to take Greek letters for space-time indices, and then distinguish between sort of the first half of the alphabet, which will be the tetrad indices, and then the second half of the alphabet will be the coordinate indices, space-time indices. And then Latin letters indices will be spatial, going from 1 to 3, and again, the first half will be, of the alphabet will be tetrad indices, and the second half spatial coordinate indices. So then we have tetrad vectors that are labeled by, so you have four vectors labeled by alpha, and then their coordinate components are given by the lambda alpha mu. And the dot product of the vectors is then just the Minkowski metric, one time-like through space-like. The tetrad directional derivatives are denoted by capital D. Those are, derivatives along the tetrad vectors. And then you have the space-time metric is just given by the contraction with the Minkowski metric on the tetrad indices of the tetrad vector. So if you know the tetrad vectors, you can calculate the metric very simply. Of course, there's no unique way of going from the metric to the tetrad vectors. The connection coefficients with respect to the tetrad basis vectors are just standard definition in NPW, and they have, of course, again, the standard property that because the vectors are orthonormal, the connection coefficients are anisymmetric on the first pair of indices. And you can write them in terms of the commutators of the basis vectors, and this then gives a way of going between the because the commutators you can write just in terms of coordinate derivatives, right, of the basis vectors, and you can then relate those to the connection coefficients and get equations for the evolution of the, for instance, evolution of the tetrad vector. And now, particularly in these first, you know, order formalisms, of course, we're dealing with the connection coefficients as our primary variables, and it's convenient then to do sort of a space-time split of the, you know, separate space and time with respect to directions along the tetrad vector and directions perpendicular to the tetrad vector, a tetrad time vector. And so you have the acceleration, the angular velocity, which again is angular velocity relative to Fermi-Walker transport. You have an extrinsic, quote, extrinsic curvature, because if the tetrad whirl lines are, in general, are not even going to be, hyper, you know, there's not going to be any hypercurvatures which is orthogonal to the tetrad whirl line. So these quantities KAB then don't really refer to any, necessarily to any particular surface, right, in space-time. And it's the anisometric part of the KAB, which is being zero, which tells you that, that it is possible to find some surface which is orthogonal. Of course, that may not be your actual coordinate time surface. So in general, the KAB will not be symmetric. And then you have this spatial dyadic, and it's convenient to just, you know, compactify that by, instead of keeping both anisymmetric pairs as sort of separate symbols, to take the anisymmetry in the first pair and then convert that using an epsilon symbol in three dimensions to a single index. And then you get, instead of three indices, you have two, and you get these NABs. Okay, this is the same notation that Estabrook and Robinson and Holmquist use. As I said, now the condition that the tetrad, time tetrad vector is hyperservice orthogonal in the sense that it, there's some hyperservice which is orthogonal to all the world lines, is that the anisymmetric part of KB, and you just need to, again, write that as a vector using the epsilon symbol, that vanish. So capital omega A vanishing is the condition of hyperservice orthogonality. And it also turns out that it's doing the same thing for the N, capital N, all that, you know, vector little n, that anisymmetric part of the capital N sort of three tensor is something which plays, you know, is worth singling out. Okay. Now the Einstein equations basically tell you how the KAB and the NAB evolve.
What was capital N?
Well, it's this sort of spatial connection with the anisymmetry converted to a sort of a vector, one vector index. So you have, so the first index of N is the direction along which you're taking the derivative in the definition of the connection, and the other two indices are the two vectors that you're, so you'd have the derivative of one vector projected onto the other vector. On the other hand, and so you have the Einstein equations, and then ordering indices, and you do the same thing in the standard first order metric formulas, and you have you get your evolution equations for the spatial derivatives of the metric by doing a coordinate derivative switch in just an identity. It's basically an identity, but it gives you then an evolution for the spatial derivative of the spatial metric in terms of the extrinsic curvature, in terms of the time derivative of the spatial derivative of the spatial metric in terms of the spatial derivative of the extrinsic curvature. It's just a derivative ordering. So now these ordering identities aren't really the same in tetrads, because your tetrad derivatives, you know, your tetrad direction derivatives do not commute, right, the way coordinate derivatives do. So So it turns out, man, it's what it's convenient to replace that with is are the basically the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. You have certain symmetries of the Riemann tensor which are not explicit when you write them in a certain way in terms of the connection coefficients. And so there are different ways of writing the Riemann tensor in terms of connection coefficients. And those give identities which you use. On the other hand, the evolution of the acceleration and the angular velocity is not determined at all by the Einstein equations. You can, in principle, specify them to be anything you like. So you have to have some gauge conditions to evolve them.
Aren't there intuitively more ways in which the tetrad can screw up than the metric? I mean, what prevents all the tetrad and roll-ons?
Well, yeah, I mean, that is...
mindlessly spinning around.
That is true. I mean, hopefully your gauge conditions will stop that from happening.
But it's a
serious issue. I mean, it's okay, so let's first consider the Einstein equations. And so we're considering everything in terms of tetrad components. And so you apply the standard definition of the Riemann tensor, and you have, you know, then in terms of the tetrad components, you have directional derivatives of the connection coefficients and then gamma squared terms. Now these really should be in quotes, initial value equations, because again, you know, these G00 and G01 only contain spatial directional derivatives, but those spatial directional derivatives contain, in general, coordinate time derivatives. And so, so to really get the true initial value equations, these are, in general are not the true initial value equations. You have to use the evolution equations to get rid of those time derivatives in these directional derivatives, and that's something you have to worry about. On the other hand, if you this hypersurface orthogonal gauge condition, so the tetrahedral roll lines are always orthogonal to your specific hypersurfaces, then it's automatically true that the D's don't contain time derivatives. And that's one reason why I think that's a better way to go. But, all right. Now, and so in the standard way, you get evolution equations. So you have the energy momentum quote constraints. And then you have, and notice this n vector, which is, again, the anti-symmetric part of this spatial connection, is what appears, is the divergence of that vector is what appears in the principal part of the energy constraint. And then the evolution equations. Okay, now here I'm using one very particular way of, there's all this freedom of adding, you know, the constraints to the evolution equations, right? Which the Cornell group has used to great advantage, perhaps. least. Now, it turns out there's one particular choice here which results in a much simpler hyperbolic system than some arbitrary choice. And that's to take the Ricci tensor and then subtract with coefficient 1 for the diagonal terms the energy constraint. Now you can see, now notice that, okay, well this contains 3 Riemann tensor terms, but this only contains 2. The off-diagonal components of the Ricci tensor also only contain 2, you know, these 2 Riemann tensor terms. Now, the thing about adding this particular coefficient is that with this, of course, you get 2 terms here because if for B equal A, so the diagonal terms, C can take 2 values without causing R to be 0. So you get 2 terms out of this, which cancel 2 of the terms here, so you still have, you know, just 2 Riemann tensor terms. And that reduces the number of sort of principal, you know, derivative operators that you have in your equations. And also, it turns out that then that, you know, now, point is, so this trick then is something in a metric-based formalism where you're dealing with metric components of everything. Because raising lower indices you know, here we don't have to, all we're doing is changing a sign when we raise and lower at most, when we raise and lower and the next. And this sort of behavior gets messed up by the fact that, you know, you have to, on the Ricci tensor, you have to, you know, raise an index and contract, and then you get, sort of a mess. And you don't get any simple cancellation like this.
So you solve that thing for the first time in derivatives, including the ones in G00? Is that the original?
Well, there are for the principal terms, in terms of derivatives, sort of the tetrad vectors, I mean, you're talking about second, the principal terms involves second time derivatives. And there, of course, there are no second time derivatives in G00. I mean, there are k's in these r's, but no second, no derivatives of time derivatives or k's.
Okay, sorry, maybe
I
was confused by something.
So you get then a time derivative of this sort of extrinsic curvature thing, and then a term involving derivative acceleration, and then these, you know, a couple of terms involving derivatives of the n-tensor. And basically the way it works out then is that for a given KAB and a given direction, if you pick a direction along one of the tetrad directions, and in that direction, there's only one term, one spatial derivative term in that direction. And so you get a very simple sort of coupling of the connection coefficients in terms of the characteristic matrix. Now, another thing is that of course, the Ricci tensor has to be symmetric, right? I mean, it's a symmetric tensor, regardless of whether you're on a coordinate or tetrad basis. So, on the other hand, this expression is not explicitly symmetric. So, essentially, you get, you know, two equations in general. I mean, again, if it's hypersurface orthogonal, it is. But you, in general, you get, for a given pair BA, you get two equations, not one equation here, because, again, KAB is not symmetric in general.
What are the others? I mean, the left-hand side is symmetric.
Well, it's so the value of the left-hand side is symmetric, but its expression in terms of connection coefficients is not symmetric.
Okay, yeah. Like
so you get some constraints out of that, sure. Yeah.
The prior rotations, because you already fixed the gauge, right? You already fixed the.
Well, I haven't talked about how I'm going to evolve the gauge.
But have you chosen the hypersurface orthogonality of one of the
No, it's principal arbitrary. It could be, may or may not be orthogonal.
Okay, so then
at this point.
The other piece is just the evolution equation for the rotation, for the anti-symmetric part of the extrinsic curvature.
So, yeah, I mean, you need both, because the extrinsic curvature, so you have two separate equations, and of course you have separate, you know, the nonlinear terms, which I didn't write, or gamma squared terms, are different in the also, you know, between the two KB, the AB, BA form the equation. Anyway, so, okay, identities. Well, okay, well, there are, you know, a number of symmetries of the Riemann tensor. Now, the construction of the Riemann tensor is explicitly anisymmetric under exchange of the last two indices. Way I've done it. It's also, it turns out, identically anisymmetric in the interchange of the first pair, given that the gammas are asymmetric on the first pair of indices. So those don't really give anything. Those symmetries don't give anything new, right? So what you get something new out of is when you do the pair exchange, when the pairs are different. I mean, obviously, you don't get anything new if they're the same. And so those equations are give you constraints. And you know, that then, because those two expressions for those two different under the pair exchange are different, you know, you get different expressions in terms of the meshing coefficients, the fact that they must be the same gives you an identity. So, and the identity then gives you evolution of this NAB tensor involving a derivative of the angular velocity and then a spatial derivative of the, or two spatial derivatives of the extrinsic curvature tensor. And it has, you know, essentially the same form except for the angular velocity substituting for the acceleration and exchanging N for K as the evolution equation for K. And also the signs are different. You know, you have minus signs in that case. But it's basically a very similar structure. Of course, the nonlinear terms, the gamma squared terms, are different. I mean, in the, for the D0K and D0N. But the principal terms are very similar. And then you have this identity, which is essentially has the same form, again, except for some differences in the nonlinear terms, as the momentum constraint for the cage, right? It involves the cage. And then you have, so that's from the pair, that pair exchange symmetry. Now there's one final symmetry of the Riemann tensor, which is this cyclic identity. And that turns out just to be that the identity, you know, the this omega b vector is the twist of the prime Bohr line, right, of the tetrad, and that it is something which has identically zero divergence within. So you get, well, with, except you are some extra terms, but of course this d is not a covariant derivative. I mean, it's just a direction derivative. All right, so, okay, but we then still have to specify an evolution for A and omega. And now there's one very simple way of doing that, and just, as I said, just to take them to be fixed, you know, what we call fixed gauge, fixed functions of time and space. And then they just sort of, they're not variables anymore, right? They're just thing, you know, given things. And that turns out to be consistent with having an you know, a good hyperbolic system. But that's not in general what you would like to do. You'd like to have something that sort of going to keep things from getting behaving badly, hopefully, in some fairly automatic way. And so, as I said, what Van Putten and Erdely do is take this connection one form, which is, and then which satisfies, and specify that that satisfies this divergence equation. And they give you equations that look like this. The Nestor condition in 4D, you get two evolution equations. You also get two constraint equations, which I haven't written, which are, you know, not all that interesting, but because in practice you only impose them under the initial conditions. And they're fairly trivial if the initial hypersurfaces, if the Bohr lines, your congruence, tetrahedral congruence is orthogonal to the initial hypersurface, then those constraint equations are easy to satisfy. Now, notice that the principal terms, you know, which are on the left-hand side here, are exactly the same in both these gauges. They differ only in the source terms. And so we sort of expect then that the behavior of the solutions in these two gauges can be pretty similar. And in fact, it does turn out, in the cases we've looked at, it does turn out to be quite similar. I mean, there's small different, you know, sort of qualitatively it's exactly the same, but there's some minor differences in the, how things evolve.
The Lorentz gauge is not a full gauge fixing, right? You still have some leftover freedom for the trial rotation, the special trial rotation.
Well, it gives you unique evolution for A and omega. I mean, there's no constraint, which at all in these, you know, there are no constraint equations here. So you're completely free to take the initial A and omega to be anything you like. Here, you're not completely free. If you really want to satisfy the nested conditions, you're not completely free to take A and omega initially.
There's more.
But the evolution.
The bottom.
Yeah. So in that sense, there's more fixing in the bottom. But in terms of the evolution, given the initial data, then it's very similar.
Nestor had a gauge where, if I remember, you could write the median mass from them in an explicitly positive way. Is this related to that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we've talked about the evolution of the connections, but now we have to talk about the evolution of the things which relate the connections to the actual tetrad vectors. In other words, how do we evolve, you know, the tetrad vectors? Well, see, I'm not sure what happened. I seem to have left out a slide. But anyway, so what are these things? Well, this capital A is when you write this spatial directional derivative. We said in general that's not going to be tangent to the space of the hypersurface, so it's going to contain, so that vector along the, you know, the spatial direct, you know, quote spatial direction that's orthogonal to the time, the Lewis world line, that vector then is not a constant time, and therefore, you know, it involves time derivatives. Now, in doing numerical relativity, you're dealing with, you know, you have some coordinate system, right, and you have some definite time function. And I, of course, I'm doing all this in the context of the Cauchy evolution. So you are evolving from one hypersurface to another. And so when you write the dA, you know, vector, you can write this as this AA quantity, which you can sort of think is the tetrad components of a three vector, and then D0, and then plus, so I'll call it, you know, sort of this partial A to denote that this thing, which is still a directional derivative, but it's this is tangent to the hypersurface. So in terms of a frame that's, you know, an observer at rest in the hypersurface, then the world line is in general, you know, going at some not orthogonal way. So this is the d0 direction, or the lambda 0 direction. Then you have the dA direction, and in the standard special way that folds up, d0 goes to the left. And then what we're doing is taking this vector and projecting it back into the hypersurface along the Bin-Gruen's world line, right? And that defines this word, the true sort of spatial displacement associated with. Right. Now, obviously, there are other ways one can do this projection, but this turns out to give us a nice way of doing it. So then the equation you get is that D0 of that A, capital A, is the acceleration vector minus the gradient directional derivative along in this real true spatial direction of the log of the lapse, and then minus some sort of kinematic terms, which involve the fact that which are proportional to capital A, which basically due to the fact that the congruence is sort of has shear and angular velocity. And then these E, A, K are the coefficients in this partial A. So partial A we're writing as E, A, K, d by dx, K. And those are the E, A, K vectors, right? And now, what's on the left-hand side is just the Lie derivative of the EAK, right, considered as a three-vector. Now, D0 By the way, you know, D0 is written in the standard way in terms of a time derivative, you know, in terms of a lapse and a shift. But it's important to note that this lapse is not the same as the 3 plus 1 lapse because, you know, if the whirl line is orthogonal to the hypersurface, it is, but if it's not, then this often has the square root of the square. You can think of this capital A as being the 3 velocity of the tetrad whirl line in a frame of an observer at rest with respect to the hypersurface. And so there's the square root of 1 minus v squared factor in this alpha compared with the standard 3 plus 1 shift. And this of course is the shift relative to the congruence whirl lines, not relative to the normal to the hypersurface, but rather relative to the congruence whirl lines. All right.
Next one.
Yeah. So these are sort of, you know, 3D curl sort of, you know, operators. And then these are sort of, these constraints are in general sort of messy, but if capital A is zero, which means that, you know, the whirl line is orthogonal to the hypersurface, then this one is just, that goes away, and this one just becomes stuff involving ends and the E's, which basically allows you to calculate the ends given the E's. This should be a B, right? Sorry. Okay. Okay. So that takes care of the evolution. And those equations basically tell you how to evolve the tetrad vectors, right? Because you can describe everything in terms of this capital A and the E. So you have 9 EAKs and 3 capital A A's and A's. Now, it's so much simpler that it only makes sense to really, in terms of starting your calculation at t equals 0, to start with the congruence orthogonal to your hypersurface. I mean, it's just so much harder to do anything else. Right, so let's do that. That means that the lambda sub 0, which is the time tetrad vector, is just equal to the normal to the hypersurface. Capital A is 0, and the lambda sub A is equal to E sub A. Now you can solve your initial Vi problem in any method you like, right, and get some initial value problem on your initial hypersurface, using whatever coordinate methods or any method you like. And so you get the spatial metric, and then you can easily then, and the extrinsic curvature, and then you can calculate the KABs from, you know, just using projecting them onto this triad, which is the same as the spatial tetrad vectors. These things are orthogonal. And you can calculate the NABs from the commutators of the E's. So that's a straightforward, so given any solution of the initial value problem, you can always calculate the initial values for your tetrad cloning. It's not a problem. But it is interesting to think about a little more, because in particular in terms of the 3D nester conditions, which are that it turns out that the trace of the N matrix is zero, and the curl, that's this grad is a covariant derivative now. So this is a true curl of N is equal to zero. So that means N is, if this is true and given the right topology, this means N is the gradient of a scalar. Those are the 3D nester conditions. Now it turns out that if you make a conformal transformation of, say, some initial spatial metric, then the, obviously then the EAK is just scaled by 1 over the phi squared. And it turns out the only thing that changes in the ends is this little na, in other words, the isometric part of n. All the symmetric part of n is only scaled by the conformal factor. It doesn't have any derivatives of the conformal factor. Those terms don't have any derivatives. So it's just the na which changes, and it changes by the gradient of a scalar. Now, the cute thing is then that what this gives you, I mean, because the Nestor conditions are coordinate independent, I mean, they're not, you know, it gives a way of defining what you mean by a bare geometry. Because so you're given the three geometry, you can solve for, you know, using, you know, you can solve for the if this you know gives you then that n is the gradient of a scalar, then you can use a conformal transformation to get rid of that gradient, right? Using and then so you can actually then make n sub a equal 0. And that then you can think of as a bare geometry, because Na is sort of involves sort of the, you know, the gradient of a conformal factor. So it's what you do to clothe the geometry by solving, you know, the energy constraint and initial value equation. And so then that defines a bare geometry in a coordinate independent way, not just saying the determinant of the spatial metric equals 0, which is very coordinate dependent.
Can you give some geometric formulation of that? I don't know, curvature squared is minimal or something like that?
Well, I don't know if anything in terms of the curvature. I mean, these Nestor conditions are geometrical conditions, right, in terms of this funny...
You have to be able to express it in terms of the free metric, right?
Well, yeah. Well, but it's non-trivial. I mean, I don't know how to do that. All right, so, but, you know, it's not a big deal. The solution is, you know, just in terms of getting a solution. Okay, now we have to deal with, in general, with the fact that the dA directional derivatives are not true spatial derivatives. They contain time derivatives if capital A is non-zero. And even if it's zero initially, I mean, you start, in general, it won't stay zero unless you explicitly force it to be zero by a hypersurface orthogonal gauge condition. So the idea is you have some system of equations then in terms of the directional derivatives, which looks like this, where C is, you know, a matrix. The Q's are vectors of all your variables. And then C is a characteristic matrix. But when you write out in terms of, you know, isolate the time derivatives, you find that then you get this non-trivial matrix times the D0 operator, which contains the time derivatives, and then leaving behind just this DF, which is a directional derivative involving only spatial derivatives. And so let's call this matrix capital T. So the true characteristic matrix is then you have to multiply by the inverse of this metric. A matrix to get the D zeros of the Q's, right? And so the true characteristic matrix then is inverse of T times what you sort of naively thought was your characteristic matrix. Now, okay, so how messy is this matrix? Well, it turns out it's not terribly messy, and it's actually possible to find, you know, explicitly to invert this T matrix in a general way. I mean, you know, not numerically, but algebraically. And at least in the case where, you know, we have this sort of simply coupled hyperbolic system that involves this Pirco way of adding the energy constraint to the K evolution equation. And And so it turns out to split up into be block diagonal, 3 8x8 blocks. The whole matrix is 24x24 in terms of just the connection coefficients. And you can show then that then you can invert T and get, and of course T acts as a symmetrizing matrix, so you get a symmetric hyperbolic system, all of which works as long as this capital A squared is less than 1, which is saying that it, you know, you don't want your tetrahedral line to be going faster than the speed of light relative to an observer at rest in your, faster equal to the speed of light compared to an observer at rest in your hypersurface. Now, that means, though, you have to be a little careful in how you choose your laps, because how capital A evolves depends on sort of, so you have, if you have some substantial acceleration of your tetrad, as you might have near a black hole, then, you know, you'd better more or less cancel that acceleration with the gradient of your laps, or else you might find that, you're basically your coherent system is breaking down, which may mean that your hyperservices are becoming null or what have you. Okay, so now in the case of, you know, we can apply this to, you know, nonlinear plane waves as a very simple first application. It's 1D, so things are hypersurface orthogonal, though not necessarily orthogonal. I mean, because even, you know, and you can do, you know, apply the Nestor or the Lorentz gauge. And you can collide circularly polarized waves. And it turns out that when you, if you start with, say, two waves, circularly polarized waves, as long as they're sort of separate from each other, then you can set the omega, this is in Lorentz or Nestor gauges, you set omega equal to 0, the angular velocity relative frame dragging. Initially, it will stay 0 as long as the two waves don't start interact, but once they start colliding, then, you know, the coupling of the in the source terms basically generates the nonlinear, you know, coupling of the two waves, generates a non-zero angular velocity. But then it sort of oscillates because there's a restoring, these gauge conditions provide sort of a restoring torque for the you know, the for the spatial orientation of the tetrahedron. And also, if you, this N11 sort of represents the rate of twist of the tetrad vectors along the one direction, which I'm saying is the direction of propagation of the wave. And so the colliding circularly polarized waves generate a non-zero twist and a non-zero angular velocity, and they sort of oscillate as and propagate at the speed of light. Once they get generated. And so you get sort of a pulse, a torsional pulse in the frames, which as the waves interpenetrate, and then once they come apart again, that pulse just propagates out in both directions. Okay, now another important special case, test case is, simple test case is spherical symmetry. And here, the point is you have to be careful not to take your tetrad along the spherical polar coordinate directions. Because if you do, there's an infinite rate of twist of, right, the phi vector near the axis of symmetry, which is, means you have a singularity in the capital M quantities. So we have to take a Cartesian tetrad. You can still use, you know, spherical coordinates. You just have to define your tetrad in a way which is Cartesian. And then when you calculate, you know, the ends and so on, well, it turns out only the anisymmetric part of n is 0, is non-zero. And also in terms of the evolution equations for k, you pick up, you get sort of commutators of these things which pick up, you know, some 1 over r, capital R terms. And that's the way you get sort of the, you know, the how you know you're in a spherical geometry rather than just a plane geometry. So, all right. So in this case, you have then basically four connection variables. You have the acceleration, or the radial component of the eccentric curvature, in other words, the KRR, you know, projected onto the. And then this NR is this, it turns out the N vector is oriented in the radial direction. And so you just have that one component of the N vector. And then you have the transverse eccentric curvature. And then you have the three sort of, then you have one component of capital A, the radial component, then you have a radial, the symmetry forces the tetrad vectors to remain aligned. Well, that doesn't allow any twist relative to the radial direction, so you just have an ERR and E theta theta, where, you know, again, you can, after you've used these Cartesian ones, you can then transform back to drive your equations. After you drive your equations, then you can transform back to a spherical frame, and that's what these E's, in fact, these sub R and sub theta here refer to, you know, vectors along the R and theta directions rather than components, rather than corner components. And you can also see that D0 capital R is this RKT, and this derivative respect to proper distance along the radial direction of capital R is 1 minus capital R times NR. And then the Nestor, now, so going to the Cartesian frame wasn't really necessary in the Einstein equations because everything, you know, everything is sort of covariant in the Einstein equations under rotations of the tetrad. But the gauge conditions, however, that's not true. And so you get, you have to be careful in driving the evolution of the Nestor equations to include the proper commutators here. And you get then this.
So suppose you take spherical collapse to a black hole, and then solve the Nestor equations to find out what happens to some of these in the initial tetrad. What happens to the tetrad?
Well, typically, you know, the world lines will, some of them will fall into the black hole. I mean, clearly, when you're near the horizon, you need an infinite, you know, very huge or infinite in the limit acceleration not to fall inside the horizon, right?
Is that a good thing, that horizon?
Well,
where we don't care because we design.
Well, you can compensate that with a shift. I mean, so if you have the right shift, you can still keep your coordinate system from falling into the black hole. And in fact, it turns out you can, if you demand that, you know, try to find a shift for which all the evolution, you know, find initial data for which all the evolution equations are satisfied with zero time, you know, zero coordinate time derivatives. You know, it's a stationary, you know, that is possible to do that consistently. You have sort of a one parameter family of initial hypersurfaces, and which is parameterized basically by the value of RKT on the horizon. Of course, it has to be negative, negative if you have a, you know, have a future black hole.
If it was a simple example where you were to collapse,
well, if you think about matter, well, so yeah, so we haven't done that, but we just worked in vacuum. But it is clear that, you know, that will drag tetrad world lines in as that forms a black hole. So the world, depending on your initial data and so on, some of the world lines may accelerate off to infinity, or and some may, you know, fall into the black hole, and there'll be some critical point which you don't know ahead of time unless you've really done the solution. And so that then, so that does mean, though, that you, you know, as well, you know, so you have to deal with that behavior of the tetrad as well as your coordinate system, right? And that's, you know, a serious issue, and that's why I think it's probably better not to use the Nestor gauge condition to evolve acceleration and velocity.
Okay.
as well as the fact that it turns out that another bad thing about the nestergation condition, at least with this particular form of the, in terms of using the constraints in the equation, these grid ordering constraints, or these ordering constraints, Riemann tensor symmetry constraints, in particular way we do, is that we're given initial data, I mean, there's no freedom, you know, I mean, the nester condition tells you that things will evolve in a certain way without any wiggle room. And if that turns out to be a bad way, that's, you know, maybe you can fix it with the right initial data, but, you know, unless, and in the vacuum case, you can figure out the initial data to get, keep everything stationary, right? But in doing, in some generic collapse case, where you don't know the solution ahead of time, you know, you don't know how to choose the initial data. So that's a serious problem. So, my conclusion then is that it's probably not a good idea in the end to use either the Nestor gauge or the Lorentz gauge, both of them have the same problem. So that means then we say go to this hypersurface orthogonal gauge. And so I'll try to wind up quickly here. So we have this is sort of the bone and muscle type of evolution. The fact that then if you hit this with the, you know, the spatial directional derivative, so we're enforcing all the orthogonality conditions, right? Then we hit this equation with a spatial derivative, and then because the acceleration is the gradient of the log of the lapse, if we commute these two directional derivatives, then we get the acceleration, right? The time derivative of the acceleration, which we can evaluate, which, you know, then in terms of other stuff, which has this form. And now this particular form is done at, you know, is taking this where you get a gradient of trace K here, you use the Menard constraint to replace that by a divergence of K, and you need to do that to get a symmetric, get a hyperbolic system. Just in general, for general 3D case, if you just keep the gradient of trace K, you don't have a hyperbolic system. But here you have a good symmetric hyperbolic system if you use it to the complete instead of getting rid of the trace gradient of trace K completely. Okay, so so this is an evolution equation with acceleration, which is determined by the evolution of the hypersurfaces, which is determined by this equation. You're free to take any arbitrary, in principle, any arbitrary f of alpha. You still have the angular velocity to deal with. You can then either set it to zero, and then it, it's a way of, so you're fixing the angular velocity to be zero, right? I mean, you can always do that. Or you can, say, use the Nestor evolution equation for the angular velocity. Now, the Nestor constraint equation that went with that for the angular velocity will not remain satisfied. But it turns out that what we can show is that if the 3 geometry satisfies the 3D Nestor condition, that the time derivative of the angular velocity will vanish in general, which means that that's sort of the equilibrium point. And so that suggests then that if you use that Nestor evolution equation for the angular velocity, it will have something that will tend to oscillate about sort of the Nestor geometry and some the Nestor frames and the spatial frames, because the question of satisfying the Nestor condition is how the spatial orientation of the frame exists in a particular slice. And in principle, there might be some way of evolving omega so that you always maintain the Nestor condition, 3D Nestor condition, but there's no obvious way of doing that, at least that I know of. So, okay. So the other thing you can do is take, now you know KAB is symmetric, and therefore you can reduce the number of variables and get rid of 3 of your KAB variables, reduce the 6 down to 3. And it turns out if you do that, and then take, in other words, you basically replace these both by the symmetric combination divided by square root of 2, then, and if you also replace as a variable AB by AB over the square root of F, it turns out you get an explicitly symmetric characteristic matrix, which is nice. And the weight you have, and then wave speeds, which are, well, plus or minus the square root of F, and then for the sort of mixed transverse, that's for longitudinal modes, and then for mixed transverse longitudinal, you get, and also some zero velocity longitudinal modes, and then for mixed transverse longitudinal, you get this intermediate velocity, and then speed of light for the rest. And okay, so I've done some calculations then with, say a little bit about the Einstein-Bianchi system. Now, again, you know, most of these systems are done in such a way that you get speed of light for every propagation for everything, but for the gauge modes as well as the physical modes. But I would argue that there's no real physical reason for doing that. You may as well try to reduce the number of variables, and you do that by enforcing all the symmetries of the Riemann tensor. And so you'd have, in general, 20 Riemann tensor variables, that reduces them to 10, which are, and then you get a hyperbolic system, again, which you don't have all light speeds, but you have physical modes, of course, have light speed, and the mix, you have sort of mixed longitudinal transverse, which propagate at half light speed, and then you have some longitudinal modes which propagate at zero speed, or it's along the hypersurface normal. So you get a perfectly nice symmetric hyperbolic system. Now, of course, all this isn't worth a hell of beans if you get unstable modes, and it's sort of the bugbear is you always have constraint violating modes, and those, depending on the particular formulation of the equations and your particular initial data, your solution, your particular gauge conditions, you may or may not, those may well have, and often do have, unstable constraint violating modes, which grow exponentially, even though it's a symmetric hyperbolic system. All right. So now the spherical Einstein-Bianchi system only has one Riemann-independent Riemann variable, which is just, the ERR of the electric part of the Riemann tensor, and there's one particular form of F I found for some particular initial data which gave at least constraint-stable evolution. Now, that's not saying that. Most other, if you vary that, any of that by very much, you probably don't get, the growth rates may not be huge, but, you do get sort of exponential type growth. And, but at least, it's better than the other systems. I mean, it turns out that if you just take the Nestor evolution, gauge evolution, or the Lorentz gauge evolution, it turns out that you get fairly rapidly growing exponential modes with large amplitude near the horizon. But this.
You really need to get the F right to 5 seconds.
Oh, no. Just particular value. I haven't done an exhaustive search yet. So conclusions. Well, I said, the tetrahedral forms, I think, do have a nice formal simplicity compared with metric formalisms, much easier to deal with just analytically. The threading gauges, like the Lorentz and the Nestor gauges, are problematic, particularly in the context of black holes where you have the congruous vertilized diving into the horizon and you're trying to juggle, you know, your coordinate system and the shift relative to those world lines in some way, which somehow keeps your coordinate system from falling into the black hole or running off to infinity, and it's not very obvious how you're going to do that in some non-trivial case. But on the other hand, the Einstein-Bianchi system, I think, really does, you know, with hypersurface, in the context of a hypersurface orthogonal gauge and a dynamic lapse, does show promise. Of course, it needs to be tested in 3D calculations. And there needs to be a lot more work done in exploring particularly dynamic shift conditions. I mean, so far I've just taken a fixed shift, and you'd really like to have a dynamic shift to try to keep your coordinate system well behaved. So there needs to be a lot more work done in looking at those questions. Okay, thanks. Well, I mean, you don't have to, but you know, they do exist.
Was that an extra problem numerically, or it's not supposed to be analytically, those symmetries be preserved by evolution, but I just wonder if that's built in numerically.
Well, that's what we've done, at least so far, you know, those are not automatically enforced numerically. It's not.
So there are extra constraints that could cause problems.
Right. Just as normal, you don't impose the energy momentum constraints.
As normally what?
You don't impose the energy momentum constraints.
Right.
Now, in the Einstein-Bianchi system, in a sense, or there's a sense in which the energy and momentum constraints are enforced exactly because you're enforcing the relationship between the Riemann tensor and the Einstein tensor exactly. Okay. But you have constraints, though, which involve, you know, derivatives of the connecting coefficients, just in terms of, you know, a given Riemann tensor component has a certain construction in terms of connection coefficients. And there are a lot more of those than there are equations that are using to evolve the connection coefficients.
Jim, so, are the uncontracted Bianchi identities on the Riemann tensor can't be enforced exactly. So in a sense, you're not enforcing those constraints. I mean, it's a question translating an analytic version to a numerical version, but I don't know of any scheme that would actually do that.
Well, I think David Meyer at JPL has some.
He doesn't. Ideas,
you know, he has some. You know, I agree. You're not enforcing them exactly.
Did I understand correctly that when you enforce algebraic constraints, which are the symmetries of the Riemann tensor, you get different characteristic speeds?
Right.
Are there analogs of that for other algebraic constraints anywhere? Seems rather surprising to me.
Well, I mean, when you sort of freeze certain things in certain ways, you're changing how short wavelength violations of constraints basically propagate. And so, you know, I don't think it's surprising that you get different speeds when you enforce certain relations between the Riemann tensor that in one system aren't enforced in another system. I mean, these are all, you know, gauge modes that you're talking about. I mean, you know, of course, the physical modes always have light speed. But
I don't quite understand why you say you have to enforce these algebraic constraints, because you have the Riemann tensor, and you write the Riemann tensor as the Bayer tensor plus Ricci tensor. And the Ricci tensor is equal to zero. That's the Einstein equation. That's what you put in exactly. And then you write the Bayer tensor as split into electric and magnetic part with EAB and VAB. And that's imposing, basically. I mean, this bit is imposing the symmetries, the correct symmetries.
Right, so.
So in the Einstein-Bianchi system, I think this should be automatically satisfied. There is no additional imposing.
Well, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, you're enforcing those symmetries in the Riemann tensor exactly. So that's different from the other systems I was talking about, where they're not imposed exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. No, you are in the Einstein Bakun system enforcing those symmetries exactly. But the relationship between the Riemann tensor and the derivatives of the connection coefficients are not being enforced exactly. So if you think of the Riemann tensor as being constructed from connection coefficients, then that construction is not exact, but just, you know, symmetries are imposed exactly. Now, now one thing that happens in spherical symmetry is that in the Einstein Bakun system is that you don't have any constraint modes. In other words, in the sort of purely connection coefficient systems, you have modes which basically involve the transverse trace of the extrinsic curvature and the, you know, derivatives of the sort of the transverse part of the transverse trace of the spatial metric, sort of, right? The whole thing.
Another point I want to make is that there are codes, numerical codes, which use Petrov approaches. These mm-hmm. are what we use for the conformal field equations.
Sure.
Based on
Petrov, right.
Which is basically the same thing as
yeah, so, yeah, I, but it.
Do you have the same wave problems from Tetrad? Some of the same answers?
I mean, what we are doing is when we're propagating the Tetrad is by Fermi-Walker transport, or, I mean, in this, what you call the hypersurface orthogonal case, one time like Tetrad vector is phenomenal.
Right, so, yeah, that's the simplest thing to do. Is
we just choose something, depending on what kind of additional structure or something, how to propagate the Tetrad from one surface to the next.
Well, I mean,
that's one of his suggestions, basically.
Well, that's one thing. That's the simplest thing to do. Is just set omega equals zero, and that's.
We haven't looked at the next.
But, you know. Now, of course, in the circular symmetric case, omega just doesn't enter at all, so there's no way of testing it. But you don't have to go to 3D, or well, you get some idea maybe from plane wave. But the trouble in plane waves is. You can't integrate for very long because the whole solution is going singular, so it's hard to interpret the stability you get if everything is sort of blowing up.
Anything else? Thank you.